All right. We're in the final section of the course. Counting down to final exams. And we're going to be talking about various types of hormone receptors today. They function as transcription factors and multiple other mechanisms. And we're going to talk about a lot of mechanisms today. That should be stuff that's familiar to you, some of it. Others of it, maybe not at all. Let's begin with gonadotropin hormones. It's a pretty complex slide, and we're going to spend a little bit of time on this one. The ones over on the left-hand side have seven transmembrane segment receptors. So what does that tell us about them? Are they inotropic or metabotropic receptors? Okay, and as you can see, they act through various G protein-mediated pathways. So let's begin with gonadotropin-releasing hormone, or GnRH, gonadotropin-releasing hormone. That is released from terminals of hypothalamic neurons in the posterior lobe of the pituitary. Everyone recall that that's the neural lobe of the pituitary, the posterior portion? Okay. And then they circulate to the anterior pituitary, posterior and anterior, right next to one another. And they trigger the production of the next two hormones, follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. The mechanism of action is through a GQ pathway. So GQs would do what to PKA activity? Nothing. Okay. Good. Everybody must have studied for the last exam.
Yeah.
Okay. The next two gonadotropin hormones are follicle-stimulating hormone, or FSH, and luteinizing hormone, or LH. FSH and LH. They both act through a GS. And GSs would do what to PKC activity?
Nothing.
Nothing again. What kinase would you expect them to stimulate activity?
PKA.
PKA, because they stimulate production of cyclic AMP. Okay. They're again secreted from the anterior lobe of the pituitary. That means they then go into general circulation. Follicle-stimulating hormone, not surprisingly, stimulates the egg follicles to cause maturation of eggs. And luteinizing hormone, depending on the gender, stimulates the follicles as well, or the testes in males. Okay. So these are considered to be pituitary gonadotropin hormones acting through seven transmembrane segment receptors. Now the other primary one acts through a completely different mechanism, and that is the hormone prolactin. Prolactin. It has targets in the mammillary glands and stimulates lactation or milk production. It's again produced in the anterior pituitary, but its receptors are not any of the types of receptors we've looked at so far. They're also not common with the types of receptors we're going to be talking about for other hormones today. They are heterodimeric in structure. The reason they're considered heterodimeric is because they're actually two parts. One is a kinase, and one is the intracellular monomeric portion of the external receptor protein. So they dimerize so that each dimer has this extracellular portion that binds prolactin, this dimeric intracellular portion, each of which bears a Janus kinase. Janus, the Roman two-faced god. Janus kinase, or Jack, J-A-K. Janus kinase. Okay. When prolactin binds to that receptor, then it activates the Janus kinases, which autophosphorylate the dimeric portion here, the two monomers on the intracellular side. And that then leads to binding of what are called STATs. STATs. Signal transduction and activator of transcription factors. STATs. Each of those two monomers binds a STAT. So you end up with two STATs bound to this dimeric receptor when it has been phosphorylated. And the Janus kinase then continues to phosphorylate the STATs as well. When they have been sufficiently phosphorylated, they then dissociate from the ligand receptor complex and dimerize themselves. They will only dimerize the STATs when they are sufficiently phosphorylated. And in that dimeric form, they can then be transported across the nuclear membrane and act as transcription factors. You have to have the dimeric form to interact with the double-stranded DNA within the nucleus. And that dimeric form we're going to see again for other types of hormone receptors, but not necessarily this Janus kinase-initiated phosphorylation event. So it's fairly complex. And we've really understood that fully about the last 5 years or so. So JAKs and STATs are important components in the cascade of events that mediate prolactin signaling. Is everybody clear on that? So there's four different sets of hormones, three different pathways by which they generate their activity. That's just one slide for the day. We've got a lot more to cover for hormones, and we're only going to hit the major ones that have some type of relationship to the nervous system. Now the next ones are the gonadal steroids. They're called gonadal steroids because they come from the gonads, the ovaries or the testes. Gonadal steroids. This shows some of the very complex biochemical pathway involved in their biosynthesis. Pretty much all of the steroid hormones begin with cholesterol as their precursor. Cholesterol, that stuff that you're constantly warned to reduce in your dietary intake. Thankfully, it's unavoidable that you're going to get some, or you wouldn't have hormones, you also wouldn't have cell membranes. Cholesterol goes through a sequence of enzymatic events and can be converted into pregnenolone. Pregnenolone, where have we heard of pregnenolone earlier this semester? As a GABA receptor modulator, but not an agonist, an antagonist.
I blame Dr. Miller.
Okay. You blame Dr. Miller?
Because he told me it was
endogenous
Valium.
No, allopregnanolone. Okay. And it's one that's involved in pregnancy. Pregnenolone can be converted into progesterone. And progesterone is one of the primary sex hormones we'll be talking about in just a moment. And progesterone serves as a precursor, I don't expect you to memorize all the intermediates, for production of testosterone. Testosterone. Now which gender produces testosterone? Both males and females produce testosterone. Okay. Testosterone can serve as the precursor for the primary estrogen, estradiol. So again, you begin with cholesterol, it's processed into pregnenolone, then into progesterone, eventually then into testosterone, and then into estradiol, or it could be processed into estradiol. So fairly complex biochemistry. We're going to concentrate primarily on one portion of this cycle, and that's relative from testosterone onwards. Again, testosterone, what's often considered the male sex hormone, is really not the most biologically active of the male sex hormones. If testosterone is acted upon by this enzyme, alpha reductase, you get the much more potent form of testosterone, dihydrotestosterone, or DHT. Alpha reductase is the enzyme that converts testosterone into its more active metabolite, DHT, dihydrotestosterone. And it's about 3 times more potent than testosterone. Alternatively, testosterone can be acted upon by a different enzyme, aromatase. And aromatase converts the what's often considered the masculine or male sex hormone into the primary female sex hormone, estradiol. Estradiol is one of the family of estrogens. It's the major one, but it's not the only estrogen. Again, whoever came up with naming schemes wasn't thinking about pharmacology students. Given that that is the primary estrogen, you would think if you were going to use E as its abbreviation, it would be called E1. Nope. Somebody arbitrarily called it E2. E1 is a related estrogen, estrone, which is an oxidated form of estradiol, or a hydrolyzed form of estradiol is estriol, E3. And they can be interconverted. I don't care that you know all these additional biochemical pathways, but knowing the 3 different estrogens might be important to you. And knowing these primary enzymes, the aromatase converts testosterone into the estrogens, and alpha reductase creates the more potent DHT. Those are the important enzymes to remember. Vibrates awfully loud. Okay. So both genders produce these hormones. The major difference is the relative activity of these 2 enzyme pathways. Now, we know and have known for quite a while now that gonadosteroids have direct effects on the nervous system. There are some nuclei in the brain which have larger volumes in one gender than the other, particularly in the hypothalamus. And this isn't a neuroanatomy class, so we're not going to emphasize that here. But this is one of the more interesting phenomenon that are expressed during the estrous cycle in females. It can also be reproduced in culture. So these are cultured neurons. Number one, in the absence of estrogens or in the presence of physiological concentrations of estrogen. Which one has more dendritic spines, the estrogen-treated or the non-treated? The estrogen-treated. More potential synaptic contacts with estrogen treatment than without. Again, as I said, this is within the physiological range. This is near the peak concentrations that would be seen within the estrous cycle. This is not what the male brain would look like because males also produce estrogens, but nowhere near these types of peak concentrations. What this suggests is that the female brain at certain points within the menstrual cycle or the estrous cycle has a higher concentration of synaptic contacts within regions in the nervous system that are sensitive to the estrogens. That's particularly within limbic structures, areas like the hippocampus, the amygdala, cingulate cortex, prefrontal cortex.
So that accounts for PMS?
Accounts for PMS. Probably not so much. Well, it could be emotion, but also those are strongly cognitive structures. And the likely underpinning of this is that it may be important before mating occurs for females to make good cognitive choices. And this is one mechanism to help boost the facility to do that. Males apparently don't seem to make those same cognitive choices. Or at least we don't have that particular biological mechanism to fall back upon. So neurons, individual neurons, and in fact the neurites of these neurons, the dendrites of them, are sensitive to sex hormones, change protein expression in a very labile fashion. How does this come about? The receptors for the gonadosteroid hormones, like testosterone or DHT, like the estrogens, are considered to be steroid receptor proteins. The unique nature of steroid receptor proteins is that they are intracellular receptors. They're not on the cell surface. In the form before they bind the ligand, before they bind DHT or bind estrogens, they're found in the cytosol of the cells in an inactive form. Okay, if they're inside the cells, what does that tell you about the hormones? They have to be very lipophilic to be able to cross membrane barriers. As a consequence, they have good access not only to the inside of cells, but to the inside of the blood-brain barrier. These hormones have very ready access to the brain. Now I've got parallel pathways from a couple different artists here on the left and right. First thing that has to happen is that the hormone has to get into the extracellular environment. If it's in the nervous system, it has to get into the brain itself, across the blood-brain barrier, and then penetrate the cell membrane. So you have to have a very lipophilic hormone to penetrate and get to the receptor itself. The right-hand illustration actually gives you the more complete picture and story of the receptor. The receptor proteins are fairly complex proteins that are typically in the inactive state bound to what is called a heat shock protein, an HSP, heat shock protein. Anybody know why they're called heat shock proteins? Because if you dump cells, and this is the way they were discovered, into water that's not quite boiling, they release a lot of these proteins. How many times in normal physiological day-to-day activity do you get dumped into boiling water? Hopefully never. But that was the mechanism by which they were discovered, and so the biologists discovering them semi-ignorantly named them heat shock proteins. They're typically released when the steroid hormone binds to the receptor. So you can measure the amount of active receptor by measuring the amount of free heat shock protein in a cell. Okay, once that binding event occurs, the ligand binds to the receptor, then this ligand receptor complex can be transported across the nuclear membrane into the nucleus of the cell. Within the nucleus, this ligand receptor complex then dimerizes. It joins up with another bound ligand receptor complex. And it's only the dimeric form of these steroid hormone receptors that can then interact with the dual-stranded DNA and act as a transcription factor to read out the genetic code. So the gene transcription that occurs is a consequence of the binding of this dimeric form of the receptor. And then, of course, downstream from that, you have the RNAs that are formed, transported from the nucleus, inserted either into the endoplasmic reticulum or into a ribosome or a polyribosome. And we know that ribosomes are expressed at postsynaptic membrane sites. They can then be translated into proteins, typically in a very strongly regulated fashion, often regulated by phosphorylation or by various other events. And then finally, the proteins themselves that have been transcribed may be further post-transcriptionally modified. They might be phosphorylated, they might be ribosylated, they might be cleaved up, they might be hydrolyzed, a whole variety of different transformations. So the bottom line here is that these sex hormone receptors and the other types of steroid receptors we'll be looking at in a moment can alter gene expression by binding within the cytoplasm, displacing the heat shock protein, being transferred into the nucleus, dimerizing in the nucleus, and then that dimeric form, then they can interact with the dual-stranded DNA.
Is the heat shock protein just working with that receptor complex and modifying it, or does after it's released, can it go and modify other proteins?
It depends on the cell type. Depends on the cell type. It can be a second messenger as well. So again, a pretty complex pathway. Not just a given G protein and you know everything else that happens. So what types of proteins then are produced by activation of these receptors? Any one particular protein? Thousands of different proteins. Depends on the cell type, it depends on prior experience of the cell, depends on a lot of different factors. So just the fact that you've got an increase in a particular sex hormone does not necessarily tell you what proteins are going to be changed, which particular proteins are going to be expressed. It's a much more complex problem than that. This looks complicated enough, right? So how many different types of steroid hormones should we worry about? One, two? Well, it would be nice if that was the case. We're going to concentrate on five. Five sounds like a lot, but believe it or not, it's not anywhere near all of the possible ones. But these are ones that have some relationship, again, to the nervous system. Let's begin with the gonadal steroids. We've already mentioned them, the estrogens, the androgens, and progesterone. Now remember, we had three estrogens with estradiol as the primary one. We had the precursor androgen, testosterone, and then its more potent metabolite, dihydrotestosterone, or DHT. And then we have progesterone. Okay. Don't worry about writing all the antagonists down. We'll get to those later on. A couple of interesting biological pieces of information. These are typically expressed as dimers when they're in the nucleus of cells. They're monomers when they're in the cytoplasm. Down to heat shock proteins. Each of the receptor proteins typically has a Hill coefficient of 4. A Hill coefficient of 4. So how many would the dimeric form in the nucleus have? 8. 8 molecules of the sex hormone or the various other hormones to cause a change in gene transcription. For most of the 7 transmembrane segment receptors, it took 1. For most of the ionically mediated receptors, what was the typical Hill coefficient? 2. So these take a lot more signal to become activated. They have a very complex structure. I don't expect you to learn all the structure as well, but one important portion is the portion that binds to the DNA. Each of the monomers has a portion that binds to the DNA. Each of them has a portion that can bind either to the ligand or the heat shock protein. And each of them has a portion that's responsible for the binding to the other monomer, for the dimerization. And again, goes back to the previous slide and those mechanisms of activation. So again, the 3 gonadosteroids were the estrogens, the androgens, and progesterone. And additionally, we have a couple of adrenal steroids to talk about. They don't come from the gonads. Where would they come from? From the adrenals. In fact, these are cortical adrenal steroid hormones. They come from the cortex, the outer shell of the adrenals. We talk about the glucocorticoids. Why would they be called glucocorticoids? Because they increase glucose utilization, glucocorticoids, which includes substances like cortisol and corticosterone, with cortisol being the primary one that's produced, cortisol. Or if you work in the McIntyre lab, you just call it cort, cortisol. And then the mineralocorticoids. Why would they be called mineralocorticoids? They affect mineral retention by the kidneys, particularly sodium retention. The primary one there is the hormone aldosterone. Aldosterone. The only antagonist that we're not going to mention again, so I will mention it now, is spironolactone. Spironolactone. Which blocks receptors for the mineralocorticoid aldosterone. There are others in that category, but that's more than enough to learn. Spironolactone. Okay. All right, so let's look at these different types of receptors. Start with the estrogens. The estrogen receptors exist in 2 different forms. What are called ER alphas and ER betas. E for estrogen, R for receptor, alpha and beta. ER alpha and ER beta. Okay, you can see them in the dimeric form here, actually interacting with the double-stranded DNA. And they typically exist in the nucleus as heterodimers. Obviously, they're monomers out in the cytoplasm. So very high levels of estrogen then encourage lots of those receptors to be activated, increases the likelihood that you'll get both alphas and betas in the nucleus to form those dimers. The receptors are distributed throughout the body, particularly in areas like the gonads, but throughout other organ systems as well, and particularly as we've seen in the nervous system, in the brain. Okay, so alphas and beta type receptors. What kind of G protein do they activate? What kind of G protein do they activate? None. No G protein mechanism for these steroid hormones. They're intracellular receptors. We went through that whole pathway like 60 seconds ago. It's already vanished from your short-term memory. We had a talk in here last Friday about the limits of working memory. I think you would have all delighted the speaker there. He said people could only hold four items in working memory. I think we got past that four limit, apparently, for people. Somebody had a question?
So, is there not obligated to cell?
Almost always, not for every type of cell, but the typical configuration is a heterodimer. Right. For certain types, you'll have a predominance. But even there, you may have heterodimers expressed, but predominantly one type or another. All right, so those are the receptors. Their mechanism of action is not through a GQ or any other G protein, even though there was lots of mutters of that there. How about drugs that interact with these receptors? Long list, but I don't expect you to learn the whole list. And this list could literally go on for about 30 pages. They're primarily used as either birth control pills or for hormone replacement therapy. Don't think we have anyone here that's menopausal. So probably not necessarily a candidate for hormone replacement. Okay. There's really three primary configurations and then variations on it that you should pay attention to. The first is the pure estrogen forms typically contain all of the biologically generated estrogens, estradiol, estrone, and estriol. Major brand name they're sold under is Premarin. And the reason for that is because of their source. Is purified from pregnant mare urine.
Yes.
Pregnant mare urine, Premarin. Different parts of each of those three words. And it's the most widely sold form of birth control. Sounds disgusting.
But it's
it is just the hormones. And in some countries, drinking urine is perfectly acceptable practice. So, not really a mainstream American practice, though. Then we have the synthetic estrogen configurations, which primarily use this synthetic estrogen, ethinyl estradiol. Ethinyl estradiol. Or those that depend on synthetic progesterones, like norethindrone, or combinations of those. So you'll have ones with high estrogen, low progesterone, high progesterone, low estrogen, or no progesterone, or no estrogen. Different ones work better for different individuals. Typically, the configuration used for birth control does not try to mimic the normal estrous cycle. Instead, typically keeps hormone levels high for a number of days and then shuts off the hormones, or at least the exogenous hormone, for 3 to 5 days. It's not on there. It's another artificial form of progesterone. And there are literally thousands of different combinations and different doses in lots of different configurations, patches, tablets, implants. All right, so those were agonists. There are also antagonist drugs. The two primary ones that are used very widely, number one are tamoxifen, which is plant-derived, comes from a plant in the Pacific Northwest that is an endangered species. so it may not be available in the future. The other one is synthetic, is clomiphene. Clomiphene. These are extensively used for treatment of breast cancer because breast tumors are very responsive to estrogen. It induces proliferation in those cells, makes the tumor larger and spread. So antagonists are valuable to stop that process. There's an additional pathway that can be blocked besides the receptors themselves. What was the enzyme that was needed to convert testosterone into estrogens? Aromatase. So there is a clinically useful aromatase inhibitor called anastrozole. Anastrozole. Typically, a breast cancer patient treated with that then would not be producing estrogen. So that could induce menopausal symptoms besides the reduction in the tumor. So tamoxifen and clomiphene are widely used estrogen antagonists, estrogen receptor antagonists. If they're going to bind to the receptor and block the binding of estrogens, what kind of characteristic would these antagonists have to have? They'd again need to be very lipophilic. They'd need to cross membranes and get to the receptors. So they need to have similar solubility characteristics through the hormones themselves. Okay, besides estrogen, was there any other hormone that's often considered to be a female sex hormone? Not prolactin. Progesterone. Okay. And besides synthetic forms used as agonists, there are antagonists. The one that's probably most widely known is the drug mifepristone. Mifepristone. When it first entered the market, it was an experimental drug, so it's still often widely known by its drug company name, RU486. But the proper generic term is mifepristone. It's what is often known as the day after pill or the morning after pill because it can interfere with maintenance of the uterine lining and thus interfere with the ability of fertilized eggs to implant in the uterine tissue. So per se, it does not actually cause an abortion. It just prevents the implantation of a fertilized egg. So it passes on out of the body. There's been a lot of controversy, and some pharmacists in the state of Texas particularly have refused to stock this drug. There are other pristone drugs, this pristone suffix, in the same category. But that's the one that's most widely known, mifepristone. These don't only bind to the progesterone receptors. They also bind to and block glucocorticoid receptors. So in the case of an individual that might have thought that they were going to experience an unwanted pregnancy, they could also have the beneficial side effect of relieving stress in several different ways. By blocking the steroid hormone receptors for corticosterones. Okay. All right, those are the biologically active androgen hormones. starting with testosterone. We had a reductase enzyme that produced DHT and aromatase that produced the primary estrogen, estradiol. There are also pathways, though, that can produce inactive testosterone metabolites, such as aldosterone and eicholinone. I always have trouble saying that one, eicholinone. These are considered to be non-feminizing and non-masculinizing forms of the sex hormones. They don't, in other words, have the sex-related effects. And aldosterone, same root word as androgynous. But they can still have some anabolic effects, effects on bone and muscle. Okay. What's considered to be the primary anabolic steroid? Anybody know from your readings? Testosterone. Anabolic steroids. Where have we heard of anabolic steroids? Sports. News. Okay, we'll get to that in just a moment. Testosterone is developmentally regulated. This is the regulation of it in males. It tends to be much more even in females. But in males, you get a major peak in production of testosterone in the second trimester in utero. This is true across all mammalian species. Obviously, the trimester is varying in duration in different species. This is triggered by hormones released from the mother and then further enhanced by hormone production from the fetus itself. Levels of testosterone production fall down to almost zero at birth. And then somewhere within the first few months of life, they hit another peak. Anyone here ever had the experience of changing a male infant's diapers?
Yes.
Not only do they like to pee on you when they change their diaper, they will often have erections. That doesn't mean that they're sexually excited by you. That is a sign of this surge in testosterone production. That stops after a few months' time. Goes again down to very low levels until what we call puberty, when it begins to increase again. Typically, though, for most males, not in a nice linear fashion, but it may go up and down for a period of time. Reach the peak levels that should be seen by pretty much all the males in the classroom at this point in time until quite advanced age, when it then begins to fall off in a gradual fashion. But since it stays high throughout the lifespan, that literally means that 80, 90, so far I think the record is 95-year-old men giving, impregnating females. Still capable of performing. That's not the typical life cycle for estrogen productions. Estrogens tend to be at moderate levels and then go up in puberty, stay up until about late 40s to mid 50s, depending on the individual, and then begin to fall off very precipitously. So quite different regulation of the different hormones. Well, let's look at it as an example, some of the effects of testosterone and DHT. In males, the primary source would be the testes. They can cross cell membranes very readily when they're transported into the nucleus. If they have not been converted to DHT, there is even alpha reductase in the nucleus to enhance their potency. It can then cause changes in gene transcription, which can have multiple effects. So one is the sexual maturation that occurs during puberty. The sexual differentiation or virilization. I think I used Harry Potter with the beard as an example there.
Oh my God.
The anabolic effects, so I think Arnold Schwarzenegger is an example there in his pre-political days. They play a major role in spermatogenesis, and they play a major role in regulating GnRH. And where did GnRH come from? The pituitary. Released in the posterior pituitary, but it's generated by hypothalamic neurons whose axon terminals are in that neural lobe of the pituitary. Okay, and the pituitary again descending off the base of the hypothalamus. In males, the primary hormone that's stimulated by GnRH is luteinizing hormone. Females, there's an additional one. What's the additional one? FSH, follicle stimulating hormone. And luteinizing hormone then plays a negative feedback role in regulating testosterone production from the testes. So this is a negative feedback cycle. So again, the primary endogenous anabolic steroid is testosterone. And it's very, very potent active metabolite, DHT. There are literally hundreds and now probably thousands of synthetic forms of anabolic steroids. One most commonly used is oxandrolone. Oxandrolone. And that's the one that got this guy in trouble. Just got convicted, I think, yesterday. This is Barry Bonds as a rookie baseball player. Typical normal body mass, bone size. This is him about 8 years later. Very potent example of anabolic effects of steroids, which he thought was just vitamins. At least that's what he continues to claim. So again, as a rookie, and then a few years later. Don't care how much exercise is involved, your head does not get physically bigger from exercise. From steroid hormone use, it can. Inducing bone growth. Problem is that the inside cavity of the skull does not expand with that bone growth in later life because the joints between the bones are already fused, unlike during normal development. So that can cause some major problems. Additionally, there's lots of other risks associated with the use of high levels of anabolic steroids, non-physiological ranges. Obviously, they can increase bone and muscle mass, but they tend to also increase blood pressure and cardiac muscle mass. What kind of heart failure is associated with increased cardiac muscle mass? Congestive heart failure. Many athletes, after using high levels of steroids for 10 years or more, their hearts look like those of an 80-year-old or a 90-year-old. Heart attack, it takes many, many people out that way. Also causes disruption in the rhythm of the heart. Statistically, there's been any number of studies showing increased aggression with excessive levels of anabolic steroids. Even normal physiological levels in males. Males tend to get arrested for violent behaviors more than females. It's not just a societal thing. Rape has been strongly associated with use of steroids.
So people who have been watching me for all this time that knew about this effect,
baseball commissioners for a long time said there was no use of steroids in sport. Period.
But people like to.
It's pretty obvious there has been. It's been well known, you know, the sources of it. So first the sources began to be regulated, then they were restricted, then they started testing. So if you test for one particular hormone, then you change to a different one. There's many, many, many synthetic varieties, and each specific test is looking for a particular characteristic. So do you test for 1,000 different anabolic steroids? Probably gets pretty expensive. Is it worth it? Well, you got all these side effects, but then again, how much did you get paid for using these steroids?
How much are his court fees going to be? It might not matter.
That's true. You think he's the only baseball player, though, that used steroids?
No.
Was he the only one that was ignorant enough to lie about it in court? Or lie before Congress? No, but for whatever reason, he's been persecuted for it more than others have. Okay. Another interesting feature, which seems to be true here, loss of hair, high levels of DHT and other anabolic steroids can produce male pattern baldness. Again, why would it be called male pattern baldness? Because males have higher levels of DHT. Another thing that came up in court testimony, I think everybody knows what I mean by the term shrinkage there. If not, I'll explain it after class. And finally, anabolic steroids have been correlated very strongly with an increased incidence of prostate cancer and also various brain tumors. So a lot of health risk associated with it for a professional sport enthusiast.
Is there any safe way to take them?
Any safe way? Probably staying closer to the physiological range of doses. Okay. Homeostasis is something built into the limits of the biological machinery of our bodies, and you exceed that at your peril. All right, there are anti-androgen hormones. There's lots of competitive antagonists. The ones that's most commonly used is a compound called flutamide. Flutamide, and these tamide suffixes gives you a clue. Just as for estrogen, there's also a blocker for the enzyme that converts testosterone into its more active form, into DHT, and that drug is finasteride. Finasteride. And these have a wide range of clinical applications. They've been used by some states for treatment of sex offenders. The idea being that they would produce a chemical castration.
Do you think that actually works, though?
The available evidence is very mixed, which means that maybe it doesn't work at all, and there is some political pressure to say that it does. Very mixed. What it is more clinically useful for is for things like treatment of prostate cancer, which is very sensitive to levels of the androgen hormones. And in fact, it's been used, in, not in the U.S., but in many other countries, for treatment of male pattern baldness. Then you would have to watch out for doses involved so that you don't have other side effects.
Mm-hmm. So for the male pattern baldness, is that like a systemic use or a local
use? It's been done both ways.
Both ways.
Mm-hmm. More typically, the things that people rub on their scalp are not to act upon DHT, but to act on growth factors and other sorts of things there, or blood supply in the local region. Or things like hair plugs where you literally just yank it out somewhere else and stick it in where it supposedly looks entirely natural. Okay. All right, so that's the sex hormones. How about the adrenal hormones, the adrenal steroids? Even worse, biochemistry, I'm not expecting you to memorize much of this. Again, you should know that you start with cholesterol, pass through multiple steps. Progesterone is a typical precursor for the other adrenal steroids as well. Don't expect you to learn the enzymes involved, there's far too many. Progesterone can eventually generate cortisol, the major corticosteroid, or corticosterone. There's much less of this produced, but when corticosterone is produced, it can also then be further modified into the mineralocorticoid, aldosterone. Aldosterone. So again, it starts with a similar pathway to the sex hormones, and then additional enzymes convert it into these corticosteroids or into the mineralocorticoid.
Yes?
Which? Oh, it should be corticosterone, sorry. I was spelling challenge that day. I'll fix it right now. Much better. Again, I don't expect you to memorize all the other intermediates or enzymes or anything else in there. One relevant drug, metirapone, is useful clinically for people that suffer disorders where they generate way too much corticosteroid. And it blocks the synthesis of cortisol. Metirapone. Why would we be interested in regulation of cortisol production?
Stress.
Does the brain have anything to do with stress?
No.
Yes, actually, it plays a primary role in stress. Through what we call the HHPA axis. PA axis. This stands for hippocampus, hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal axis. Hippocampus, hypothalamus, particularly the paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus, pituitary, and we'll talk about both anterior and posterior pituitary again in a moment, and then finally the adrenal cortex. The outer shell of the adrenals, HHPA. Okay. So we'll start with the hippocampus, particularly with the pyramidal neurons within the hippocampus. They're the output neurons from the hippocampus, and they release glutamate into lots of different structures in the nervous system. They have a synaptic connection with the paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus. Primary role of glutamate there is to excite those hypothalamic neurons. When they excite these neurons in the paraventricular nucleus, their axons go down not to another nucleus in the nervous system, but into the posterior lobe of the pituitary, what's often called the neural lobe of the pituitary, shown right here. These are axons coming down from those neurons, not synapsing on other neurons, but dumping substances from their terminals out into the circulatory system, into what is called the pituitary portal circulation. Because the primary target of things that are dumped out in the posterior, the neural lobe, from these neurons, is cells in the anterior lobe of the pituitary that are not neurons. This is not a synaptic contact between posterior and anterior. It's a circulatory connection. So the people that discovered the substances released were neuroscientists. Endocrinologists use this name. They call it CRH, corticotropin-releasing hormone, because it circulates. Neuroscientists, recognizing it was coming from neurons, called it CRF, corticotropin-releasing factor. And it was a lab down the hall from where I did one of my rotations in graduate school that first reported this in Virginia, CRF. CRF or CRH are the same thing. They're released from these axon terminals in the posterior lobe. They circulate through this portal circulation to the anterior pituitary. It's called CR, a corticotropin releasing hormone or factor. The cells they act upon are called corticotropes. One of the many populations of cells in the anterior pituitary. They're derived developmentally from the neural crest. So they look like neurons, except they don't have dendrites and axons. They do have vesicles. They do release hormones. The hormone that's released from these corticotropes in the anterior pituitary, this part of the pituitary, dump out into the general circulation. And this hormone is called ACTH. ACTH. Adrenocorticotropin hormone. Adrenocorticotropin hormone. So it goes through the adrenals from the corticotropes. And it's a hormone. So how do hormones get around the body? Through the circulatory system. So they go down to the adrenals, to the cortex of the adrenals, and stimulate receptors there and cause the adrenal fascicular cells, or those in the fasciculata, to release cortisol and other corticosteroids. And the other name we had for corticosteroids? Glucocorticoids. So far, that's all a positive feedback loop. Not actually feedback, positive feed forward pathway. Hippocampus gets excited, it excites the paraventricular nucleus, causes release of CRH or CRF in the posterior pituitary. That causes release of ACTH from the anterior pituitary. That circulates through the body until it hits the adrenals and causes release of the glucocorticoids. So what do glucocorticoids do? They increase glucose utilization, increase your heart rate and blood pressure. They also suppress the immune system. This is the longer term component of the stress response, not directly mediated by the sympathetic nervous system. This is the outer portion of the adrenals involved. When the sympathetic nervous system stimulates the adrenals, what portion does it stimulate? The medulla, the core of the adrenals. And what gets released from the adrenals then? Adrenaline or epinephrine, same thing. That's the shorter term component of the stress response. Much faster acting. Peak levels of corticosterones or cortisol typically take 45 minutes to occur after a stressing event. And then they can stay at peak levels for a considerable period of time after. It can take hours to fall back. The mechanism to shut that cycle off is as these steroid hormones circulate through the body, they can cross the blood-brain barrier and have access to receptors in the nervous system. In the area of the brain that has the highest concentration of corticosteroid receptors as those pyramidal neurons. Anybody know the second highest concentration, second highest expression? Pyramidal neurons in the amygdala, the other area of the brain that's involved in stress responses. So it involves multiple areas to generate the stress response, eventually a negative feedback loop because cortisol shuts down the firing of hippocampal neurons. Okay. So he knows a lot about ACTH. Nobody. Okay, well now you're going to know a little more. ACTH comes from a precursor protein that is called POMC. This is the full protein chemist view of POMC. Pro-opio-melanocortin, POMC. Pro-opio-melanocortin. That gives you a lot of clues that it has something to do with stress, right? Opio. No, not at all. POMC can be cleaved up into several different types of peptide signals. One of which is one of the primary endogenous opioids, beta endorphin. We'll be talking more about the opioids in another few days. The relevant one for stress is right in the middle of the structure of POMC. ACTH. In fact, ACTH biologically is found in several different lengths. A short, only 24 amino acid one, and then the more common one, a 39 amino acid form of ACTH. The structure of ACTH, in fact, contains some additional signaling molecules. One called MSH. Portion of the structure of ACTH, it's also found in another location within pro-opio-melanocortin. Anybody know what MSH is involved in? Making you feel hungry, or sorry, not hungry, that you're not hungry any longer, that you're satiated. It's in the signaling pathway for the leptins. So depending on what type of peptidases act on POMC, you can end up with different peptide signals. To generate from POMC ACTH, first you have an endopeptidase that cleaves off this end of the molecule. This end, since it's got additional signals besides beta endorphin, doesn't get turned into an opioid. But then you need an additional peptidase to attach to the carboxy terminal of the protein and cleave off this end of it so that you just have the ACTH signal. A different carboxy peptidase could generate additional signals. So it takes at least two peptidases to chop POMC up into ACTH. We mentioned peptidases earlier this semester, cleaving up proteins, as opposed to synthesis to generate things. So where are the targets for ACTH? Where are the receptors found for ACTH? Not corticotropes. Comes from corticotropes in the anterior pituitary.
Oh, you meant the fasciculata.
It's found not in the outermost shell of the adrenals. That's called the zona glomerulosa. And that's where the receptors for angiotensin II were found. What was angiotensin II important for? Being thirsty. It caused the release of aldosterone, the mineralocorticoid, which causes your kidneys to retain water and retain sodium. Okay. Instead, it comes from this further in zone, still within the cortex, the zona glomerulosa, which contains glomerular cells. I'm sorry, the zona fasciculata, which contains fascicular cells. Abbreviated ZF, where you can spell out the full Latin. Zona fasciculata. And that's where the receptors are found for ACTH. ACTH stimulates release of the glucocorticoids or of the corticosteroids, which is sometimes abbreviated CST. And the primary one of those is cortisol, or if you're in the McIntyre lab, CORT. Cortisol. Both the glomerular cells and the fascicular cells are in the cortex of the adrenals, which is different from the medulla, which is where epinephrine comes from. So what stimulates release of the glucocorticoids? ACTH. What stimulates release of the mineralocorticoid? Angiotensin II. Okay. So these things just circulate around, no problems, right? You produce some, it can be used. Not quite. Remember early in the semester, we talked about plasma binding proteins. Plasma protein binding affects the available levels of all of these hormones. When you put in a given amount of hormone, most of it ends up bound. Only a little bit is available as the free hormone. Binds primarily to two binding proteins, globulin and albumin. There are lots of others, but those are the two major ones, globulin and albumin. And as you can see in the right-hand column there, most hormone, including exogenous hormone, ends up bound to plasma proteins. That means most of it can't have a biological effect in that bound state. So for the person that was injecting large quantities, non-physiological doses of anabolic steroids, most of that money was wasted. Only a small percentage of it was available to have its effects. In fact, the particular one that Mary Bonds got in trouble with initially has additional problems associated with it. Causes disruption in insulin secretion as well.
Just to let you know, your clock's about 10 minutes slow.
About 10 minutes slow?
We're right. right at.
So we're right at 215, which is good. Okay.
The next one.
Two more quick slides. Okay. Complicating factor. Cortisol, the primary corticosteroid, also binds to the mineralocorticoid receptor. So can it have effects on water retention, as well as stress-mediated effects? Other ones, like cortisone, don't. Many of the anabolic steroids don't. Obviously, the mineralocorticoid aldosterone does bind to the mineralocorticoid receptor. So different hormones don't just bind to their own receptor. Some do, some don't. The last slide I wanted to show you for today, some of the clinical corticosteroids. One you're most likely to get, you want to apply it as a cream, also given as injection, is cortisol, marketed as hydrocortisone. Cortisol. It has the property that it also binds to the mineralocorticoid receptor. You might get dexamethasone. It has the odd property. It's not lipophilic enough to cross the blood-brain barrier. It is to penetrate cell membranes, but not five or six layers of them like the blood-brain barrier has. Betamethasone is often used. It doesn't bind to the mineralocorticoid receptor, just to the glucocorticoid receptors. I think that's more than enough information for the day.